And a good Friday evening to you, and welcome to Your Opinion, Please. We have a regular half-hour program tonight without any special subject, no special guests, no gimmicks of any kind. This is Your Opinion, Please, just as it was originally created, what is it, about 3 years ago, Ken, something like that?
You know, that has still never been resolved.
I know. It just started late in the year, like in November or something. And I would guess it would be this year, this November would be the third year. I think it's been on the air for about 2.5 years.
See, and I would guess, I think that it was November of 1998.
That's longer ago than that.
Yeah, so I'm thinking that that we're looking at 4 years.
And you're younger than I am, and your memory's probably better, you know. When you get to be my age, the years just all run together. You know? It's just terrible.
It could be that you're trying to block out much of the past few years of your opinion.
Oh, after the censorship, it just is. 657-2941 here in the Billings calling area, outside of Billings, 1-800-441-2941 to talk about whatever may be on your mind. We had two really good forums this week on public radio. This last Monday, a forum on the Montana economy, past, present, and some speculation about the future, and some really good speakers, participants in that. And then last night, we had Dr. Hugh Kirtler talking about education reform and a healthy conversation with a group of discussants on that, and that went very well also. So your public radio station, once again, has provided you with some in-depth discussion of some important things, and we hope that you got a chance to catch some of it, because you won't hear it anywhere else. We have a caller on the line from
Lewistown.
Lewistown, good evening.
Hello, Marvin. How are you doing this evening?
Pretty well.
Actually, I had wanted to call and compliment you on the economic forum that you had. I believe it was Monday night.
Monday night, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good. I wish that more of our economic discussions could be done on radio instead of conference rooms in some city someplace.
Yeah.
But there was one point that I wanted to make a comment. I've been waiting all week for a chance to do this.
No, you've got it. You've got it now.
At one point, at the end of the discussion, there was a question from the audience, and it was on the subject of politics. And the questioner from the audience had posed a quote from a politician describing how rural politics buried urban politics in Montana. And the panelists struggled with that, didn't understand it, and I wish they'd had somebody from the political science department there on the stage, because I think they could have clarified it. But that, in fact, does happen. When I was taking political science courses back in the mid-1960s, that was one of the things that we studied in state government, was how minority rural cultures could politically dominate majority urban cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens very consistently state across state. It's kind of one of the big dynamics of politics in Montana right now. What happens is that an effective minority can consistently dominate an ineffective majority. And to use Montana as an example, what I like to say is kind of sarcastic, but it's true, that one cowboy can outvote 10 city slickers.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why is that the cowboy votes and about 8 of the city slickers don't.
Right.
And the 2 who do vote split their vote.
You cowboys aren't of a diverse perspective on politics?
This is one of the great strengths of, and also probably fatal flaws of rural culture in America since the days of the Grange in the late 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
The agricultural people learn to stick together and cast an organized, unified vote in order to keep and acquire more power, even though they were a consistently shrinking portion of the population. And in fact, today are less than 4%, depending on what number you look at, 3% of the population, but they just got a $80 billion increase, raise in pay to the Congress.
Well, now, I have a question about that, because most of the commentators I've heard, and even you'll notice on our panel last Monday night, people said immediately, well, hardly any of that's going to real farmers. Can you comment on that?
Well, that's almost irrelevant. the key point in people's minds, the perception out there in the community is that you got to stick together regardless, because at some point you'll get yours.
Yeah.
Or you'll get a support system that keeps you on the land, even though Archer Daniel Midland got most of the money.
Mm-hmm.
That's the logic. Now, the great fatal flaw is that this whole process, as it's worked with rural versus urban America, has created a wall. There's has resulted as a big cultural isolation of rural America from urban America. And at some point, the bubble's going to burst.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, there will be a radical change of life in rural America, and I'm afraid it will not be entirely a constructive change.
Well, won't it be what we've been warned about, corporate farming, and then the people will, there'll be a lot of people working for the corporate farms, but they'll be working for somebody where the decisions are made maybe in another country, even if not in a major city.
Well, you know, when you look at what's going on in the world, slowly but surely, multinational corporations are replacing nation states as...
Yes.
As, you know, as our identity.
Sure.
And...
you think that's good or bad?
Without reform of the corporation, it will be bad.
Okay.
You'll need something akin to the American Revolution to... take it apart and put it back together again so that common people can live with it.
Okay. And I think the same thing, but I wonder how that comes about. I mean, when the bubble does burst and people find that they're so powerless and so ignored in their interests that they finally rebel, I'm just curious as to how that will happen and whether it'll happen at the ballot box or something violent or what?
At the cash register.
At the cash register? Yeah, you think so?
Well, you're talking about the three B's of power now. I think it was either Saul Alinsky or somebody else said there are basically three sources of power. One is the ballot, one is the bullet, and one is the buck.
Yep, that's right.
And you have your choice. Look at what it took in history of Western civilization to create the right mix for an American Revolution to take place.
Yeah, it's true.
Unique circumstances. It will be, I think I know how Thomas Jefferson would have answered your question.
Mm-hmm.
Bring up the people and mm-hmm. Storm the Bastille or whatever.
Sure.
But the fact is that it's very rare circumstances that create an opportunity for changing something as big as a multinational
mm-hmm.
corporation, the G7 complex. What should happen is make these changes piecemeal and slowly through, you know, democratic reasoned processes. That's probably the least likely thing to happen.
Tom Friedman of the New York Times, I'm sure you're acquainted with him, he has said about the TWO demonstrations and so forth, he said thousands of people showing up in business suits and ties would just have a profound effect, because they would realize that these are not street people, but they are educated, good-thinking, solid Americans who insist on reform. What do you think of that?
I don't think anything that happens out on the street is going to change what happens in the corporate executive suite without actual force of law or one of those three B's.
Okay, or the threat of violence.
Yeah, that's correct.
Right. Well, you're very interesting. Thank you, and I hope you call. Have you called this program before?
It's been a while.
Yeah, well, make it more frequently. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very much. Yes, good caller there, and we have a caller on the line from...
Beehive.
Good evening.
Good evening, Marvin. I was just wondering, it's just a simple question, why the people in Montana act and... pretty much do Democrat but vote Republican. Never figure that out.
They
quite.
Do Democrat and vote Republican? Tell me what that
means.
They
act Democrat and they vote Republican.
What does that mean?
Well, I just, they're a lot kinder. And I come from a Republican family. They're just a lot kinder than they vote.
I
never figured that out.
So you're saying Democrats are kind Now George will.
Not necessarily, but they're kinder than Republicans in general.
Now, George Will would say that they're compassionate to a fault. Not necessarily the people of Montana, but the people who vote Democratic are compassionate to a fault.
Can compassion be held to a fault?
That's what he says, yes. Because what makes this country work is individualism with very few checks on it. And
I don't argue with that either.
And when you
don't mean you can't be nicer than Democrats as a whole are nicer than Republicans, and the people in Montana are nicer on the whole than most Republicans, but they still vote for them.
See, I know some really nice Republicans. I guess I'm going to have to look more deeply into their souls.
Well, I know some nice Republicans, too, because they're the ones who got the money to party out.
Okay, all right. Thank you.
Whatever.
Thank you very much. All
have
right.
a good night.
All right, that's an interesting notion. Democrats tend to be more communal, there's more of a sense of community. Democrats use the word community a lot more than Republicans do because they tend to think more in communal terms. But that's just a tradition, and I'm not sure that... I mean, the Republicans tend to talk a lot more about individual initiative and that sort of thing, but I'm not sure that means that either one of them is nice or not nice.
I'm just going to completely stay out of that one.
Yes, okay. We have a caller on the line from...
Bozeman.
Bozeman, good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Are you a nice Republican or a nice Democrat?
I'm a nice independent.
Okay, good. Thank you. Go ahead.
Maybe I'm not so nice. I don't know. Just a note for the first caller. There was a frustrated progressive member of the Montana legislature who, in the days of the Anaconda Copper Company, when they pretty much dominated the state politically, was fuming and thundering on the floor of either the House or the Senate, I can't remember which one, and he pointed to the Capitol Dome and he said, "This dome may be made of copper, but it's shaped like a Stetson."
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the ranchers of eastern Montana had tremendous power even then. But what
I thought the copper companies owned them or bought them out. I mean, that's the mythology. Or was that the governor?
Well, the Anaconda Company owned the newspapers, with the exception of the Great Falls Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
And they pretty much dominated the state. I suppose it was a little more blatant then than it is now.
Well, yes, I assume so.
They don't buy them now. They just rent them.
Yes, well,
what I wanted to talk about,
leasing is much more popular now. Go ahead.
Was the local report that's coming out of Wyoming, where the state of Wyoming, which certainly has an interest in the Yellowstone snowmobile debate, has announced that that snow coaches produce more noise and more pollution than these new four-cycle snowmobiles.
What are snow coaches?
Snow coaches are the vans that are modified to run on tracks, or there's a specialty vehicle built by Bombardier, which is the old type of snow coach that they've used in Yellowstone since the 70s.
I've never heard a van in my life that sounded anything close to the obnoxious sound of a snowmobile.
Well, I haven't heard the new snow machines myself. They're just here in the last year or so. But I've been around the park once on snow coach and many times on snow machines, and I have to say that I'm absolutely dubious of that claim. But granting that our friends down in Wyoming would not have such a lack of integrity as to elect a governor who would lack integrity and therefore would put out a specious document like some people might suspect this is.
Even if it were in his economic interest to do so?
Yeah, I'm being a little facetious now, but if these snow coaches are as bad as snowmobiles, I think they both ought to be banned. Because actually, that is my program. I actually think that this winter access to Yellowstone is something that ought to be pretty considerably reduced. And one of the problems that develops from that, there has been a contrary research done, I think, coming out of the university here in Bozeman by a wildlife student who maintained that that bison would be migrating out of Yellowstone in the winter, whether they had these hard-packed roads to travel on or not. But that certainly hasn't been my experience. I've been familiar with Yellowstone in the winter all my adult life, and this out-migration of bison is entirely a production of the plowed roads, and or the hard-packed roads, mm-hmm. You have that, whether you have snow coaches or you have snowmobiles or both.
Why don't we have horse-drawn coaches in Yellowstone Park in the winter? What would be the problem with that?
Well, it would be pretty tough going. And
why would it? Because horse-drawn, my heavens, horses drew stagecoaches and so forth for really hard traveling.
You aren't going to take horses 40 miles into Old Faithful from West Yellowstone.
Okay.
It'd be a two-day trip, and you'd have to have a herd of horses at Madison Junction.
Okay.
And the impacts on that are, it's probably not very practical.
Just sounds like a lot more fun.
That by grooming the roads for snow machines or for snow coaches creates the bison out-migration problem. And that problem, and it also allows the bison population to get larger, because when the bison used to winter in the park, they were trapped in the thermal areas, and the winters are so severe that the winter kill regulated the population. The only exception to that were the bison on the northern range, which could migrate down the Yellowstone River. But those bison that are coming out of West Yellowstone, and incredibly enough, the bison that occasionally even migrate over the Absarokas, over Sylvan Pass, and out towards Cody, that would be absolutely extremely difficult, if not impossible, if it weren't for these. And this, the winter use in Yellowstone was developed before anybody gave any thought to the consequences.
Sure, of course. Of it. Isn't that how we usually behave?
Well, yes.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, and once there's a vested economic interest, then it becomes really difficult to undo it. Because people say, you know, I make my livelihood this way, and this is a major source of income to our community. What do you mean you're going to reduce it or take it away?
Well, now we have this proposal in Congress that national parks are going to have to float any proposal they have for management by the local chambers of commerce. You've got to love the U.S. Congress.
That's right. That's right.
Already, in the case of, say, Yellowstone National Park, since we've been discussing that, and it's nearby, that the congressional delegations of the three surrounding states have an inordinate power to affect policy in one of the nation's most prominent national parks because their colleagues consider it a local issue and they defer to them.
Sure. Well, I've lived in five states and worked in five states, and I have yet to encounter a chamber of commerce that represented the interests of the whole community anywhere. I think it's a very narrowly focused organization, which is just fine, but it should be recognized and dealt with for what it is, and that is representing a very, very small but very powerful group of people in the community. And we saw that in a recent election here in Billings. Thank you very much.
Good night.
For your call. Okay, 10 minutes before 7, we have a caller on the line from...
So, you know, if the people in the 50s had just gotten off their hind ends and developed the hover cars that we were all promised would be here in the year 2000, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
I actually went on a hovercraft on Lake Ontario once. They sent hovercrafts back and forth between Buffalo and Toronto, and it was just a fascinating thing to watch, just floating above the water and sort of levitating there, you know. We have a caller on the line from...
Cody.
Cody, good evening.
Hi, gentlemen. I was actually going to talk a little bit about the history of corporations, but I have to respond to that last man that just called.
Okay.
The Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Interior, in charge of national parks and fish and wildlife, happens to be the former Cody Chamber of Commerce director.
Okay.
Paul Hoffman, who a long time ago worked for Dick Cheney for a few years, and he, shirt-tailed himself right into having the direct oversight of Yellowstone National Park and fish and wildlife, which means with grizzlies and wolves, but Mr. Hoffman was the chamber director here for 12 years, and he was constantly nagging Yellowstone Park. He actually protested at the east entrance against the closures, and he just was an antagonist to Mike Finley in Yellowstone Park the whole time he was in Cody, for exactly the reasons that you cited, which were the economic interests of the first town outside the park.
Sure.
being beholden to, you know, a healthy access to Yellowstone summer and winter. And in my opinion, this is really bad news for Yellowstone and winter use and everything else. That it's just exactly the kind of person that the Bush administration has been putting in these key positions.
Mm-hmm.
They find people who will take a marching order and run it out, and Mr. Hoffman is not going to be good for winter use in Yellowstone if you ascribe to the values that that man was espousing about, you know, the bison and
sure.
the fact that we've probably got a little too much winter use in Yellowstone as it is right now, because it's a totally different world in the winter than it is at the other seasons.
Now give us your short course on corporations.
It's real interesting that corporations didn't exist much before 1600 or 1700. And the reason being that the English government, or actually the crown heads of Europe, didn't have the capital to finance the sailing ships that they needed. As soon as the Far East opened up, Asia, the Near East, and whatever, they needed cotton, they needed silk. They wanted the things that India and South Asia had, but they no longer had the means to go get them. As soon as Vasco da Gama sailed around Africa and opened up the Indian Ocean, everything became kind of militant, and particularly the Dutch and the English needed to build a lot of ships in a hurry. And the only way they could do this was by using private capital, because the crown's money was expended really quickly building big enough boats and enough of them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where corporations and so-called holding companies came from. And what we have forgotten, and that man that called up at the beginning of the program was very astute. I'd like to hear a whole show with that guy.
I would too, yeah.
Knows a lot about this, but corporations in the beginning were chartered by the crown, or in, as we would call it today, the state. And as you know, if I wanted to incorporate my little business, I have to go down to the Secretary of State in Wyoming, and I have to get articles of incorporation and la-di-da.
Mm-hmm.
And I pay my $10, and there I am. But interestingly enough, even though you have to run through your state government to get this charter to be a corporation, the people of the state have very little recourse towards the behavior and the performance of the corporation that they have given the power to be chartered in the first place. And you know, a lot of corporations go to Delaware because their incorporation laws are really quite easy. You know, mm-hmm. they make a lot of money off that. Wyoming's pretty good in some ways. It's a great tax haven. But the man was dead on when he said that the people really don't have a recourse to hold corporations accountable or for their behavior and the exploitation that they wreak. And now that they've gone multinational and global, the history of globalization actually goes back to the slave trade, the militancy sure. of the open seas, and opening up the Far East. And you can say that the whole American economic system, and therefore the world system, is based on 17th century English banking. And we really haven't reformed it much since then. All the electronic transactions in the world are still made according to the rules of the Exchequer of London in the 1700s, about the time of the American Revolution, the French Revolution, and everything else that was going on. And we really haven't, you know, got up to date on that stuff. We're still running by old rules that entirely benefited the stockholders and the people that put up the money for this, because the crowns were rather weak. Corporations have way too much authority.
Mm-hmm.
What they can do, given what they were vested in by the state. And it's really too bad that the people of the states don't really have a little bit more accountability towards the corporations that they themselves charter.
It's interesting that it seems to me to be as dangerous to the idea of individual gumption and entrepreneurship to deal with these monstrous corporations as it is for governments. In other words, I would think that libertarians, as well as more collectivist types of people, would be just as equally as upset with this trend. But, you know.
Oh, yeah, the total exploitation of people. I consider human capital to be the most valuable capital of all, not gold, not the money, not any other resource. But for some reason, corporations do not place the value on human capital, on the human resource that I really believe they should. And this is especially true right now when I'm wearing a pair of $100 Reeboks here that were probably made by somebody in the Philippines,
sure.
getting paid 20 cents an hour.
Sure.
And maybe cost all of $3 to get imported into the U.S. through Saipan, which is a territory, so they don't have to pay any duty on it because it's a U.S. territory. So they actually, it's just like they were made in California, even though they're coming from Asia using Hong Kong workers.
Even though a lot of the things that are said, and a lot of the things have been said in this program tonight, would suggest regulation gets misused almost always. And it's a difficult contradiction, it seems to me, that we live with.
It is regulation. Marvin, when you talk regulation, you have to work within the system that it exists at hand. What we don't need is more regulation. We need a reformation.
Okay.
We need to reform the system.
Okay, how do we do that?
It pretty much like what Montana did in 1972, drafting a new constitution. Wyoming needs one, too. You got to go back pretty close to square one, take a hard look at it, and just bring it forward.
The climate isn't right for that, though, is it?
I don't know. It's like I said, the corporations have gotten so much power, politically and otherwise, that it's going to be so hard to undo what they've spent 400 years doing. You just can't do it overnight. It's going to take 400 years to undo it, I would think. But now that you can move money around the world electronically, instantly, and people actually are making millions just working on the fringes, just staying one stock market ahead of the of the wave of the day, while things are going down in Tokyo, so let's go to Germany and, play off of that a little bit. And they just keep staying one step ahead, and somehow at the end of the day, they've got millions of dollars, and they haven't created any wealth or done anything but just move money around.
Well, we should have a show in which you and the first caller tonight are our resource people, and I appreciate your call very much.
Noam Chomsky comes to mind, and I have taken up far too much of your time. So let's see if you can get another caller in.
All right, thank you very much. Marvin. All right. And we have another caller on the line from
Bozeman.
Bozeman, good evening.
Good evening. The reason regulations usually don't work in government, especially in the last 30 years, is you end up with appointees like Paul Hoffman in government.
Mm-hmm.
The reason socialist governments have fallen throughout the world is because of government subversion from within, and then a constant onslaught from corporations.
Sure. Cronyism and other forms of corruption, sure.
Oh, yeah. Completely. And Paul Hoffman, if anything, epitomizes the absolute values of cronyism.
Mm-hmm.
If you can even say cronyism has values. But, I mean, that man, it's surprising to me that environmental groups haven't jumped on that guy more than they have, but because Republicans have wised up, they aren't going to appoint a Secretary of Interior who's not going to get through a confirmation process.
Mm-hmm.
But they can appoint people like Paul Hoffman, who are actually going to make the decisions, who actually can control some money.
Yep.
And that's where the problem lies.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
All right. That was a good call, and you got a lot in there in about 1 minute.
Yeah.
We need another person to do that now since we're so close to 7 o'clock.
We have two callers left.
Okay, two callers with 1 minute each.
First, Billings.
Billings, you're on the air for 1 minute.
Okay, real quick. I miss the dulcet tones of the woman you had on.
So do I.
A snow coach is basically a modified half track with skis in place of the front wheels.
Okay.
And an insulated body over it.
Okay. And what kind of engine is it?
Oh God, it's a Dodge.
Okay.
V8 or V6.
Okay. Now, one person was arguing with the statement that somebody made that these things make more noise in the park
they
than the snowmobiles.
Do you ever been around a half track?
No.
They sound like the devil's thunder.
But they don't have to. I mean, why do we have to have vehicles like that in the park?
I don't know. And a third idea, Marvin. Your next fundraiser?
Yes.
Get T-shirts made up. Do you remember Marvin the Martian? Put your face
Joe
in
Sample.
Place of his.
Joe Sample calls me Maniacal Marvin. And maybe we should have,
And the slogan can be, contribute now or I'll blow up your planet.
That sounds like a Ken Siebert production. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Sure.
All right. We have one more minute for one last caller.
From Roberts.
Roberts, good evening.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to talk about government regulation and everything. Just express an opinion about the Forest Service's following government regulation and taking private property from individuals over on the Stillwater.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of frustrating. We were involved with one of those cabins, and it's come in the news again with Bruce Crippen's deal, but, there's two other cabins up there, one of which belongs to a group of people, and the Forest Service just taking it away. you know.
Well, isn't there an agreement that after a certain period of time,
yeah, there is.
It will revert back?
And they extended it, but the thing is, the area where these cabins were when they were built back in the 30s
mm-hmm.
was not wilderness.
Yeah.
It's wilderness by declaration, not by fact. We have a trail that goes up toward those cabins that you see people 4 or 5 miles back in there with high-heeled shoes.
Mm-hmm.
People walking into an area with high-heeled shoes is not exactly wilderness.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
There's more to the story of Crippen's Cabin than is meeting the press.
Well, next Thursday you call and tell us that.
Okay.
Thank you much.
You betcha.
All right. And good callers tonight, all of them. And thank you, Ken, and thank you, Dan Eichlin. And we'll be back next week.